Welcome to Holden Village. Tonight, in the Creekside Room, Sherry Tan will be speaking about household chemical hazards. So, let's listen in on Sherry.
Human health is certainly a very significant reason to be concerned about chemicals in the home. You want me to move
for you to stand or sit?
I'm going to stand.
Okay. I'll just point the mic in your direction.
Oh. You want it away from the overhead, probably, so you don't get the hum. So human health is one reason why one would be concerned about chemicals in the home. I happen to be concerned about my pets, too, and their longevity. You spend a lot of money on vet bills as it is, let alone add to them by unnecessarily exposing those little critters to chemicals in the home as well. Of course, there are issues regarding wildlife and plants and beneficial insects that can be affected. So all kinds of issues related to your actual place of residence. But in addition, there's sewage treatment, the wastewater treatment, the stuff that goes down the drain, and what can happen to that treatment system down the drain somewhere. I think all of us spending some time at Holden get sensitized to what goes down the drain in terms of volume of water, because we want to prevent the drain field from being overwrought with just liquid, volume of liquid going down it. But of course, there are a lot of other things we can dump down the drain that could do in our septic tank or could do in the wastewater treatment plant if it's a big municipal system. There are also groundwater and drinking water issues. In Seattle, they did a great big study in the mid to late 1980s about the amount of toxic substances that went into the Seattle wastewater treatment system. One-third of them came from residences. One-third of the toxic substances came from homes and homeowners doing stuff, not from the big industries, businesses that make roofing tar, that kind of thing, but from you and I. Even today, we dump the equivalent of 4 Exxon Valdez's in oil down the drain and into storm sewers every year in the United States.
It's like motor oil in cars?
No. Use motor oil, use transmission oil. Even with all the oil pickup programs, we still dump a lot of oil in a lot of inappropriate places. If you think about the kinds of products you have in your home, it's very likely you have solvents, acetone, methyl ethyl ketone, which is in paint stripper, perhaps methylene chloride, which is in paint stripper. You can buy both of them in gallon containers at places like Ernst and Eagle Hardware and the other hardware stores around, although the price is going up rather dramatically in recent years as compared to in the past.
Isn't even something like nail polish remover a solvent?
Absolutely. Nail polish remover is an excellent example. Ethyl acetate or butyl acetate. Mineral spirits is another example of a solvent that you may use to get chewing gum off something. Even things like furniture polishes often have large amounts of solvent in them. Interesting spot we have on there, isn't it? I guess it's there for good. Even stuff like furniture polishes have large amounts of solvent in them. Of course, paints, lacquers, brush cleaners, paint strippers, mentioned a minute ago. Of paints, of course, latex paints are the safest. Oil-based paints have the most materials that are likely to be deleterious to the environment. Fortunately, we don't use much in the way of lead-based paints anymore, but there are still lead-based paints in many people's homes. I just heard of a horror story that I won't go into the details of, but it happened in Connecticut to a friend of mine's daughter, where the owner of the apartment, the owner of the house, had the outside of the house scraped and sanded, and it turned out to be lead-based paint. It was summer, the dust got inside, it's contaminated their furniture, and they're having a very expensive cleanup bill just to pay for taking care of the lead-based paint that was inappropriately removed. Pesticides, wood preservatives, slug bait, fertilizer with weed killer, disinfectants are all examples of pesticides beyond the stuff that we put on our roses. Household cleaners could include detergents, something to open your drain, like Drano. The shower scum removers, which are pretty toxic materials, powerful stuff. Spot removers. Auto products, of course, we have things like transmission fluid, motor oil, gasoline, batteries, antifreeze, and other products. If you have hearing aids, you may well have mercury-containing batteries. Those little button batteries have mercury in them. Hi, come on in. If you want to be at Household Chemicals.
Yes.
Good.
Be in
Household Chemicals. At. Hobby products. How many of you have hobbies that use chemicals? What kind?
I use tunnel oil and petroleum distillate type products.
Mm-hmm. Wood refinishing.
Yeah.
Lead in the solder and stained glass. Yeah, right. Other examples? Well, I, of course, used to have a household, little home chemical kit, but don't do too much of that anymore. But photochemicals, anybody here do photography at home? You can get some pretty good assortment of chemicals with photography. Contact cement, if you glue together model airplanes, rubber cement has solvents in it, a whole variety of kinds of products that hobbyists use. Can you think of anything else that ought to be on this list that I've left off?
Like treatment chemicals for pools and spas.
Oh yeah, excellent example.
Repeat that, please.
Treatment chemicals for pools and spas. Chlorine-containing compounds that are used in your pool to kill off the bugs or used in your spa to kill off the bugs. Surfactants to help keep scum from building up in your spa. Think of anything else. Well, there are a whole bunch of chemicals that we do indeed come in contact with on a regular basis. Now, as consumers, we make decisions at three points. Purchase, use, and disposal. Which of these is the most important?
Purchase
is the most important. If you don't buy it, you don't have to worry about using it. You don't have to worry about disposing of it.
And they won't
make it. And what? And they won't make any
market.
Money.
Right.
I already mentioned at the beginning before you walked in that one of the things we're going to talk about is saving money. These are the three key points, and what I want to spend a little bit of time on particularly is purchase. Now, the American Chemical Society has actually put out a publication through one of its committees called Less is Better, to try and persuade chemists to purchase smaller amounts of material, to buy the right size for the job, rather than the large economy size. And that, indeed, is really critical. It is often a better idea to buy the small bottle and actually use it up rather than buy the big bottle and have it sit on the shelf until it kind of turns into goo and you end up throwing it out anyway, having used only about the same amount as the small bottle. Of course, if you've gone out and bought paint lately, you look at the gallon of paint for $17.99, and you look at the quart of paint for $15.99, and you go, it's only $2 more to buy the gallon. Why buy the gallon? Why not buy the gallon and get four times as much? Well, are you really going to use four times as much? So size is a critical decision to make when you're purchasing some kind of material. Buy the right size for the application that you're going to use it for. Everybody's been told, read the label. You always hear, read the label. But unless you're a chemist, sometimes it's pretty difficult to make informed decisions after you read the label. Anybody red label on an angel food cake mix box.
Half the food we eat is like that.
Well, one of the ingredients on the label is sodium dodecyl sulfate, or sodium lauryl sulfate. Anybody read the label on your shampoo bottle?
Yes.
Sodium dodecyl sulfate, or sodium lauryl sulfate. Also, you'll find ethylene diamine tetraacetic acid on both, or EDTA. Angel food cake mix box shampoo container. Why? It's foaming. The SDS is a foaming agent. It helps stabilize your angel food cake. Now, it's there in very small quantities, and it is harmless. I mean, there's no problem with eating SDS, although usually I gross people out when I bring a subject up. There's no problem with consuming small quantities of it, or in consuming small quantities of EDTA, ethylene diamine tetraacetic acid, but they're both there with the idea of being foaming agents for stabilizing foams in your shampoo or your angel food cake. Well, how are you to know that? How are you to know that from reading the label? So that whole list of chemicals there, you may be able to pick some stuff out, but don't feel badly if you can't. I do want to point out some key words, though, in a minute. Watch for the names of solvents, however. And remember that on the label, the things are listed in the order of the amount that's present. So they're listed from highest concentration to lowest concentration. So look at those first few things in particular. Another issue with labels occurs on pesticide containers. Anybody read a pesticide container and you see those active ingredients? And then you see some bunch of stuff there, pyrethrins or malathion or the name of some pesticide. And then it says inert ingredients. And then it says 95% or 90%. Doesn't tell you what those inert ingredients are. Those ingredients are not chemically inert necessarily, but they don't act in the way that the pesticide acts. So when it says inert, it just means that they don't have the same mechanism of action of the malathion or the pyrethrins. But they may well be solvents, they may be detergents, they could be any number of other materials, not water. So they're not necessarily chemically inert, they're just inert in the mechanism that pesticide works. Yeah?
Well, I was just going to ask you what the definition of inert meant.
On a pesticide, all inert means is that it doesn't act in the same way as the pest-killing material.
Right, and you already answered it, so that's why I was...
Yeah. But it doesn't mean that it's chemically inert or biochemically inert or doesn't have some other side effects. And there are people who indeed have allergic reactions to some of those inert ingredients. BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, has been sprayed all over the Puget Sound region in recent years. And it's a bacterium that gets in the stomach of moths and is lethal to the moths. The moths happen to have a basic stomach, or an alkaline stomach, where we have an acid stomach. So the bug doesn't hurt humans at all, doesn't hurt animals at all. It hurts moths, it hurts butterflies. Unfortunately, some people are allergic to what's called the sticker, or the glue that glues the bug onto the leaves where the moth comes along and chews it up. That's an example of an inert ingredient. Fortunately, not a lot of people are affected by it, but some are. Anyway, I'm going to come back and talk a little bit more about the label later on. At the point of purchase, think about what your purpose is for using the material. Do you really need to use an elephant gun when a fly swatter will work? You know, is it overkill? Will a little bit of elbow grease make the difference? Rather than using, you know, the strongest possible solvent you could come up with. Now, aerosol versus non-aerosol is a very interesting issue. If possible, I believe in always purchasing the non-aerosol or the pump, the hand pump. One of the reasons is when you have a bottle with a hand pump on it, you can almost always open it up and add a little bit of water and rinse the material out and just use it like you would normally use that product. It's just a little bit more dilute. In a spray can, you can't get the material out of the bottle, so it means that some portion of that material is going to end up at the landfill. Now, a pump versus a spray is very controversial when it comes to lung specialists. The pump, the aerosol pump, usually has a small amount of alcohol in it. The purpose of the alcohol is to lower the surface tension so the stuff sprays out better. Unfortunately, those spray droplets are about the right size to end up in your lungs. And probably when you've used shower cleaner with a pump on it, you've noticed how it kind of gags you after a while. That's because it's not cleared by your lungs very well, and that material can move on down. So if possible, choose a non-aerosol, not a spray, not a pump. It's actually safer than either of those, particularly if it's somebody who tends to be sensitive to chemicals. And then likewise, think about the fate. Where's the extra going to go? Is it going to end up contaminating your stream? You know, where will the material end up after you've used it or if you don't use it?
In connection to the non-aerosol, how are you dispensing that if you're not using a spray?
If a bottle, you squirt some onto a rag and wipe it on. Yeah.
I have a question about there's a place that we can take hazardous waste in our city. What happens to it there?
Let me get to that in just a minute. I will come back to that. That's a really good question. How do I identify? I just told you, you're going to have a hard time reading the labels. So if you're not a chemist, how do you identify which products are indeed hazardous? Don't let something that says natural or something that says organic fool you. Something that's natural can be just as toxic as something made by a synthetic organic chemist. A perfect example is lye. Lye comes from wood ashes. It's pretty natural, but it's pretty nasty. Likewise, organic is a word that has no legal definition. Anything can be labeled organic. When it's an official organic food, you know, there's a trade association of organic food people who are concerned about pesticide residues, but using the word organic has no legal connotation. Some key words, though, do indicate a hazard. If you see poison, carcinogen, corrosive, caustic, volatile, flammable, explosive, caution, warning, or danger, there is indeed a legal definition associated with those words, and there is indeed a hazard associated with those words.
What about biodegradable? That isn't always good, right? Because it doesn't always do what you think it's going to.
What biodegradable means is that it will be broken down in a wastewater treatment plant when it comes in contact with the bugs in the wastewater treatment plant. Today, non-biodegradable detergents are illegal in the United States. They have been since 1971. So when it says biodegradable, it probably is biodegradable, but it's not necessarily a sign that you're doing something good or bad.
Well, the thing I was thinking about is that one of the plastic bag companies got in big trouble for saying
right.
It's biodegradable, and they said no, in normal landfills it really wouldn't biodegrade.
Right. Those were those quote biodegradable plastic bags. They had a lot of cornstarch.
It had to have air.
Yeah, exactly. It had a lot of cornstarch in it, and the idea was that the bugs would eat up the cornstarch. You're absolutely right. In the landfill, there are no bugs there to eat up the cornstarch. So
there was no bugs, no sun, and no air, and it didn't biodegrade. And here were all these people thinking it was good.
That's right. That's right. There are more plastics today that are photodegradable. Those pop can rings that come around the pop cans that, you know, you've all seen the icky pictures of ducks or something with them around their necks. Today they are made out of photodegradable materials. Still doesn't mean you shouldn't cut them up before you toss them in the trash. But they become brittle with time because if they're in the sunlight, they will break down. But it's strictly if they're in the sunlight. If they're in the dark or, like you say, they're in a landfill, they're there. are there forever. Okay, the three words, danger, warning, and caution. Danger is the worst. It means the material is either extremely flammable, corrosive, or highly toxic. So anytime you see the word danger, you should assume it has the greatest hazard associated with it. Warning is an indication of moderate toxicity. Caution is lower toxicity. So that's the hierarchy, legally defined. If something does not have these words on it, does not have danger, warning, or caution, it means that it's non-flammable, it's not corrosive, and it's not toxic. Still doesn't mean you should necessarily eat the stuff, but it's definitely substantially safer. Now, sorry this is small, I should have redone it. Decided to throw it in at the last minute. This is something I use when I'm talking to my chemistry students about hazards. Flammable. When something is labeled flammable, we tell our students these materials should be handled in a fume hood to carry away the vapors. We tell the students that they should wear gloves. Yeah, fume hood is where an enclosed hood with air that carries the vapors away from you. We tell them that they should wear gloves and goggles and that there should be nothing in the room that could act as an ignition source, no kind of open flame, nothing that could cause a spark.
You should turning on a light switch could cause a
spark. Exactly.
Some people don't know that.
So anytime a material is labeled as flammable, you definitely should use the very best ventilation you possibly can, because a chemist would literally handle that material in a fume hood. Likewise, protective gear. Lots of us don't stop to think at home to wear protective equipment, and that doesn't mean just buying a pair of gloves at the grocery store that are designed for using for dishwashing. Most of those flammable solvents will move directly through those gloves. Those gloves are not chemically impermeable. If you go to a hardware store, you can find chemically impermeable gloves, and that's what you should get. You should look for ones that are specifically labeled for handling chemicals. Around work, we use gloves that are made out of butyl nitrile. They're blue, they fit nicely, and they're very chemically impermeable. Very often, when we're working with chemicals in the lab, in a situation where something is flammable or toxic, and we're maybe working in a hood but want further protection, we'll wear a respirator. And at home, it's often a very good idea to have a respirator as well for handling these kinds of materials. When anything is labeled toxic or poison, again, goggles and gloves, eye protection is critical. How many of you use goggles at home? Good, good. Today, yes?
I've got a question, maybe not relevant, but when you wear goggles and you wear some kind of mask, and the goggles mist up, is there any way of getting rid of that?
There is. You can buy antifog, like what scuba divers use. You can buy it at a dive shop, and it'll prevent the inside from fogging up so much. The other thing you can do is buy a little bit higher quality goggles, because the ones we sell to our students actually have antifog coating on the inside.
Where do you get those?
Safety supply
house. Any college chemistry lab would sell you a pair. Some sell them, some don't. We used to sell our students crummier goggles, and we thought we were saving them money, and they'd fog up, and then they put them on their forehead, and you know, it doesn't do much good for your eyes if your goggles are on your forehead. So we started selling them a higher grade that have the anti-fog inside. But go to a scuba store and get the anti-fog that people use for scuba masks, and it'll work just fine. Yeah.
for goggles, it's not sufficient just to wear your regular glasses.
No.
Right? It needs to be something that protects all around.
Right. And if you wear soft contacts like I do, one, you shouldn't wear them when you're using flammable solvents around solvents at all. But two, if you insist on wearing them, like I'm afraid I'm one of those people since I can't see without my contacts, it's absolutely imperative that you wear goggles and that you let people know that you have soft contacts in your eyes. Those soft contacts will actually protect your eyes in the short run from chemical exposure, but the chemicals will soak into them, and in the long run, they can do your eyes significant damage. I wear my glasses when I know I'm going to be exposed to something at any kind of elevated concentration, but it's a real stickler. Chemists are real sticklers about soft contacts.
And that's just for the flammable category?
Flammable, particularly because flammables are volatile materials. Anything that's flammable means that it evaporates into the environment. And they're particularly bad. Toxics and poisons very likely don't evaporate into the environment. If it's labeled flammable and poison, it's really nasty stuff, and there are those do exist. But you know, looking for the word flammable is the key word in terms of it being volatile.
We moved into a house about a year ago and found a very old bottle of carbon tetrachloride, and I knew that this stuff I didn't even want to be, you know, within arm's reach of. And to my best of my recollection, I found nothing on the bottle that said that it was hazardous, and upon further investigation, saw that it was used as hair shampoo and as, you know, your basic solvent all-purpose cleaner around the house. So I think for older chemicals, you know, this stuff is.
You're absolutely right. And even worse, carbon tetrachloride happens to be non-flammable. That's why it was used as a dry cleaning solvent for so many years. It's very, quote, safe. It just happens to be a human carcinogen. So it wouldn't have to be labeled flammable. It certainly, you know, any of it that was manufactured in the last 20 years would probably be labeled a suspected human carcinogen, but an old bottle, you're absolutely right. And that's one of the kinds of things that needs to go to a household waste pickup day right away. You can find some amazing things when you move into houses. A friend of mine moved into a house in Seattle and found about 50 pounds of mercury sitting in the back corner of the basement. Turns out two owners previous had been interested in reclamation of gold, and the previous owner had just left the stuff stuck in the back corner because he didn't know what to do with it. Corrosives, again, goggles and gloves are the kind of thing that we would use. Anybody use a corrosive around the home that you can think of?
Drano,
yeah, what?
Well, I guess it's not really around the home, it's outside, but I like a car, so I have lots and lots of batteries and battery acid. I always have my gloves and my goggles.
Drano is very alkaline in pH, battery acid is very acid in pH. You just hit the two ends of the scale between Drano and battery acid. Mix them together, you get a very nice violent reaction. Just bubbles and foams and sends off lots of gas. Oven cleaner. Oven cleaner is probably the thing you use under the nastiest circumstances because very often you'll have your oven a bit warm while you're doing it. Extremely corrosive. Any contact with skin may result in a burn. Oxidizers. Oxidizers are things that react violently, particularly with organic chemicals. A good example of an oxidizer is hydrogen peroxide. Now, normally around H2O2, normally around the home, we use hydrogen peroxide in 3% solutions. But if you take a product like Clorox 2 or some of the other powdered non-chlorine-containing bleaches, they're pretty powerful oxidizers. Should you spill that on an organic, you could have a problem on your hands. And then irritant. which would be anything that would cause some kind of chemical irritation. Those are the kinds of categories we use in the chemistry lab to look at possible risk from a chemical. Flammability, toxicity, whether it's corrosive, an oxidizer, or an irritant. These things can get inside of you, ingestion or eating it. That may come from eating in contaminated areas. When you're using these chemicals, don't have your can of pop sitting there. Don't eat in the area. Go somewhere else where you're not using the chemicals. And as it points out here, even something like applying lipstick or chewing gum could be of risk. Absorption means that it moves through the skin or through eye tissue, that it's absorbed through the skin or eyes. Many of those organic solvents, many of those flammable solvents can be absorbed through the skin or eyes. Methylene chloride in paint stripper, methyl ethyl ketone in paint stripper are good examples, acetone are good examples of substances that can be absorbed through the skin. Inhalation, of course, means breathing the material in. And likewise, many of those organic solvents can be absorbed through your lung tissue and directly into your bloodstream by inhaling them. Okay, so you've made the decision that you really must use your hazardous chemical. First of all, follow the label. The call that places like the Washington Toxics Coalition and the King County Health Department least like to get are, I just mixed together some spray for my roses with this other stuff I had, and then I sprayed it on the foundation of my house inside, and it's really weird, you know. They get a lot of calls from people who misapplied materials in applications that they were never intended for. I had a very sad case of a woman, elderly woman, who showed up at PLU about a year ago, who had hired a kid to apply a paint with a fungicide to kill off mildew. And he'd applied it inside her mobile home. And it was specifically designed for exterior application only. It said it on the can, and she's going, what do I do? Well, I mean, she had a very serious problem. There was no easy solution. She said, you know, I can't stand to be in my home. It smells so badly. Then she kind of compounded the problem by getting a hold of the material safety data sheet and deciding that the material safety data sheet you can get on every chemical, and it lists all of the various hazards. And this was a brown paint, and it said on there that the material was a green solid. And so she was sure the manufacturer was liable for this material. And I'm trying to explain to her the reason it says it's a green solid is because some of the stuff that's in the brown paint was a green solid. So she's trying to get the manufacturer to do something, and I'm going, lady, you know, the manufacturer has no liability here. You misapplied this material. I don't know what ultimately happened, but we did get the health department and a senior service group involved to try and help her get her place fixed up. But, you know, it was just really tragic misapplication of material in the wrong place. Of course, never mix products. My little example of the rose stuff. The best example is Comet, which contains chlorine.
And bleach.
And, well, chlorine and ammonia. Yeah, Comet has the bleach in it, and ammonia has NH3, ammonia, in it. When you mix them, you make a gas called chloramine, which is extremely toxic.
So a cleaner like, there are cleaners that have ammonia and then Clorox, and people use those to do their clothes.
That's right. And they may well gas themselves. It doesn't really smell that bad. It just makes your lungs feel really awful, and it's quite toxic. It can be lethal. Of course, as a kid, that was one of the first experiments I did when somebody told me not to do it. I figured out it wasn't smart then, too. But definitely never mix products together because you don't know what the chemical reaction is going to be. You can change materials to limit your exposure. There are a variety of adhesives today that are solvent-free, that don't have those volatile solvents like methylethyl ketone or acetone or heptane in them, and water-based formulations. Many, many, many paint manufacturers have gone toward manufacturing latex-based stains and latex-based varnishes. They historically have not worked quite as well, but they seem to be improving very rapidly. Sometimes you still want to use an oil-based formulation, say spar on a boat, for instance, is an example where the water-based formulations don't do it yet. But the water-based formulations for most applications are infinitely safer. 3M has made, 3M, which manufactures lots of kinds of adhesives, has made a major corporate effort to eliminate all solvents possible in every process within the company. And they've reduced their solvent use from 1970 to today by 90%. They're using 10% of the solvents they did back in the early 1970s. I've already tried to emphasize the necessity for wearing appropriate protection, buying chemically resistant gloves, using a particle mask when you're working with something that's dusty, but recognizing that a particle mask does absolutely nothing for chemical exposure. For chemical exposure, you really must wear a respirator with activated charcoal cartridges in it that will absorb the chemicals. And wearing protective gear like a shop coat or a rubber apron, something that will protect you from spills onto your body. Good ventilation and, quote, using common sense. Yeah.
Just one more question again. Where did you say you could get some of this appropriate protection? You indicated that the hardware store, the chemical resistant gloves, the particle mask probably. I've not ever seen or know where to get a respirator.
You can get a respirator at a place at a big hard at a, one of these big hardware stores like Home Base. They have them. There are safety supply companies. Look in the yellow pages under safety supply. But I put money that if you go to one of the really big hardware stores, we have Eagle Hardware in the Seattle area, and Eagle Hardware I know has respirators today. Part of the reason that they're becoming very common is because workers are now pretty much required to use them. And as workers, employees are required to use them, they're getting more common for ease of purchase. I can't overstress the using common sense and having good ventilation. Tributyl tin bottom paints were sold for boats for a number of years. Very, very effective at keeping stuff from growing on the bottom of the boats. And they were epoxy-based, meaning that you mix two parts together and they set up to form a really good hard residue on the boat. And tributyl tin is equally toxic to humans as it is to the critters that would grow on the bottom of the boat. And there were several fatalities before people figured out that you really did have to use good ventilation in the process of applying these epoxy-based TBT bottom paints. The reason I bring it up is because you can buy consumer products that can be lethal. It is possible. Moving right along, hobbies. A couple of hobbies were mentioned earlier on. Weavers can run into dyes and mordants, which are toxic. Solder, of course, for jewelry or stained glass. In terms of artists, it's still possible to buy various kinds of art paints that have heavy metals in them. For the most part, the acrylic paints are okay, but you can still buy things like cadmium yellow that has cadmium in it, a very toxic metal. You can still buy lead-based art paints, too. Still possible. auto repair. Many people who do home auto repair consider gasoline to be a superb solvent. The amount of benzene in gasoline has dropped over the years, but there is still benzene in gasoline. It's a known human carcinogen. You should never clean car parts in gasoline because of the fact you can be exposed to the benzene and other chemicals present in there. You should use mineral spirits instead, which are much, much safer. Woodwork, there are of course a variety of solvent strippers, etc. Woodworkers, sawdust, particularly with hardwoods. The sawdust from hardwoods can cause lung disease. Well, now if you want to put together a safe cleaning kit, of course it requires a bit more elbow grease in some cases, but you can do pretty much all of your cleaning around the home with baking soda, liquid soap such as Murphy's, salt, borax, distilled white vinegar, scouring powder like Bonami, lemon juice, and vegetable oil. And I should have brought some along and I failed to. You can get a sheet from places like the Washington Toxics Coalition or in Washington, the State Department of Ecology. Oregon, I know DEQ has it, that gives you recipes for using these various substances to do just about all the kinds of cleaning that you commonly do around the home right now and spend big bucks for. I mentioned the Washington Toxics Coalition because I like their group a lot. They put out a whole series of flyers on safer alternatives. This one happens to be paint solvents and wood preservatives protecting your wood and your health, where they discuss safer alternatives for a whole variety of materials. They've got a long list, everything from managing fleas through weed management, through managing tent caterpillars, etc. That you know, people are thinking about all these kinds of alternatives.
There are also library books too. There's one called yes. Non-Toxic Home by Deborah Lynn Dadd. It's very, very good.
Yes, D-A-D-D. She actually has three books altogether. The Non-Toxic Home and a couple of earlier ones on various kinds of formulations that you can put together. She is an interesting character. She ran into severe problems from exposure to chemicals and has worked very hard on multiple chemical resistances. Multiple chemical sensitivities, I mean, in terms of exposure to chemicals of all sorts, from building materials, insulation in your walls, carpet glue, etc. And I would describe her as pretty aggressive. There are a variety of other books you can find in the library as well that are probably a little bit less aggressive than she is. Some of the things she proposes, like using cucumber skins for stuff, you know, I've just never found anything that a cucumber skin was good for. But I don't mean to badmouth her, but she just comes up with some things that kind of stretch the realm of possibility a little bit. How many of you have household pickups in your area?
Recycling?
For hazardous materials, hazardous waste.
You have to take it.
You have a place you can take them.
Yeah.
Periodically. Sometimes they go around the area and they're going to be at some place for a few days.
Right. Right. Sometimes they'll open a center for a few days or a day or a weekend, and sometimes they establish permanent centers. In Tacoma, how many of you are from Western Washington? Where are you from?
Oregon.
Minnesota.
Yes.
Minnesota's done a pretty good job over the years, and of course so has Oregon. Oregon was a little bit slower than Washington in one thing, and that was establishing pickup sites. City of Tacoma has a phenomenal site today where if you're going to the landfill, there's this huge recycling center, and then right at the end of the recycling center is the household hazardous waste drop-off place. So it's really, yeah, it's really well situated. But definitely, if there's something that you're not going to use, that's where it needs to go.
What if you've got like an empty pink can? The pink can's essentially completely empty. Is it worth, do you have to take it down with a...
No, they won't take it. They're not interested in empty paint cans. What they want you to do with an empty paint can...
They want it if it's got stuff left in it.
...is pry off... What they'll tell you to do with any latex paint or paint where the can is essentially empty is pry off the lid and let the paint evaporate, let the solvent evaporate so it dries out, becomes hard, and then throw it in the trash.
Good. I'm glad I didn't do something terrible.
No. I just put a bunch of empty ones in the garbage, too.
No, that's exactly what they would tell you to do.
Because once it's empty, there's no problem.
That's right. Now, actually, that's a really good point, though. If you use something up, and it's, quote, empty, and it's a water-soluble material, make a practice of triple rinsing it. Rinse it three times, and use the product, like whenever a detergent bottle, you know, I finish up a detergent bottle. Always rinse it three times. Triple rinsing it, and pesticides definitely. Triple rinsing is what is considered appropriate disposal practices for pesticides. And I find it works well with everything else too. So I always triple rinse all my bottles. And then they're very safe, as safe as anything, to go in the landfill or go into recycling. Household hazardous waste pickup days or drop-off points. This just happens to be the relative percentages dropped off. This happens to be at a Tacoma pickup. But in terms of cleaners, 62% of the cleaning products that were dropped off came from residents, came from people who bought the stuff and then decided not to use it for one reason or another. Solvents and paints, the number was substantially lower, but oil, it was 51%. Over here at cosmetics, 66% of all cosmetics that were dropped off in hazardous waste pickup days came from residences. And that includes things like what you mentioned, fingernail polish remover, fingernail polish, people drop off mascara, it actually has some metals in it, all kinds of cosmetics get dropped off at these events. And then medicines. You can drop off medicines at household hazardous waste pickup days as well. Medicines that you no longer need or want. It's an excellent way to get rid of them. With some medicines, it's fine to dump them down the toilet. But with antibiotics, if you dump antibiotics down the toilet, it can affect the wastewater treatment plant. Or if you have a home septic tank, it can kill your home septic tank. So never dump antibiotics down your toilet. Stuff like waxes, car waxes, etc., are dropped off by residences at household waste pickup days. The one thing that's been very disappointing with household waste pickup days is that the volume of material has not dropped off. People are dropping off just as much today as when they were started back in 1987 and 1988. So it means that people are still buying the stuff, still using part of it, and now transferring the disposal burden to the household waste pickup day. Now, she asked, what happens to those materials? In the city of Tacoma, pesticides, if it's legal, they use them. They use them on the parks, the rose bush gardens, whatever. They use all the legal pesticides. Illegal pesticides, the ones that are banned, either go for incineration at a place like a cement kiln or get bulked up in lab packs in 55-gallon drums and go to a hazardous waste landfill. Yeah?
Well, we are talking about chemistry and reactants and products. What type of efforts are being made to take some of these things that are being dumped and perhaps reacting them with something or doing some sort of reaction with them to get a product that's not hazardous? what sort of efforts?
You mean in terms of disposal of the materials at the end of the line?
Yeah, turning them into something else or something less.
Unfortunately, that's really difficult to do. You can take your acids and your bases, you know, your battery acid and your Drano, and you can neutralize them, and they do that. But beyond that, it's very, very difficult for anybody at the end of the line to deal with it. So it all goes back to that point of purchase, buying the stuff in the first place and changing manufacturers' formulations so that they're less hazardous. At the end of the line, it's very difficult to deal with. They bulk oil old paint and use the paint commercially. They were selling it in Tacoma for a while, but that was kind of a bust because the colors are usually kind of mud brown, institutional green, and battleship gray. But they'll use them on, you know, various kinds of government buildings. We've all seen government buildings that look like they used them. Well, they probably did use recycled paint. There are a variety of paint companies that do take paints back and put them back into formulations. Preservative paint has been pretty successful in blending recycled paints, and they had a big campaign in Seattle where they were selling the recycled paint to raise money for the Woodland Park Zoo. It was, you know, kind of a PR thing. But for the most part, you know, that kind of thing is, you know, it's a Band-Aid at the end of the line. The decision needs to be made up front. Batteries can go back for recycling. EverReady now takes batteries back. You can actually mail your batteries to EverReady if you want.
The city of Tacoma recycles them. We'll pick them up at your door.
Yes. The state of Washington car batteries have a $5 tax on them, so if you turn in a car battery and get $5 back on it, because you paid that $5 when you bought the battery. It's really funny, there's a place in Tacoma that has this big sign up, free battery disposal. Right.
$5 a piece for it.
Pretty lucrative business if you can get anybody to turn them in. Most of the places like Sears in the state of Washington just take the battery back and give you a credit on the purchase of your next battery. So it's just automatic. They are legit about the way they handle it. Metals, the city of Tacoma ships all of its metals to either Simon & Sons, which is a metal recycler, or General Metals, another metal recycler. General Metals in Tacoma happens to be the only metal recycler in the whole Pacific Northwest that takes old appliances and squishes them down and recycles the metals directly.
What's the name of the company?
General Metals.
General Metals.
It's a really sleazy operation.
Some metals are really hard to get rid of than others.
Yes.
I have old aluminum and old, it was partially aluminum, but not all. It was a thing that you hung your clothes on. And when the thing broke, you wanted to buy a new one, and getting rid of the old one was a pain.
Yeah.
I think I finally ended up putting it out on one of those days when they pick everything up.
It disappeared.
I hope they did something with it. But I called several places to try to recycle it myself and couldn't.
We very religiously peeled the cork, the wine bottle foils off for years back when they had lead foils. And we have this box of lead foils that we can't get rid of. They didn't go to the landfill, but they're sitting in our garage. But it is all lead. I mean, it's like it's many years worth, and it's probably 10, 15 pounds of lead. Now, that's a good idea. That's a real good idea. A battery recycler. Good idea. Thank you. Green glass right now has a value of zero. Brown glass, white glass is worth about $15 a ton. So when they recycle that, they actually get money for it. There's a severe excess of green glass, particularly from all the wine bottles in the Pacific Northwest right now. Yeah, those Northwest wines. That recyclers, I mean, it's like been a big subject at recycling meetings. You know, can you bottle your wine in any other color glass? And the problem is, if you look at the wine bottles on the shelf next time, you'll see it's a whole range of hues of green glass. And Rieslings go in one color, and Chardonnays go in another, and Gallo goes in another, and they're different colors of green glass, and the wine vintners are very picky about the actual color. Toxics Coalition put out a booklet in cooperation with King County and Metro in Seattle called Buy Smart, Buy Safe. And if anybody has a question on a consumer product, we can look it up in here. The neat thing about this is they actually, the guy who put this together is a scientist, who actually rated all kinds of different kinds of cleaners, et cetera, based on acute toxicity, chronic toxicity, physical or chemical hazards, and environmental impacts. And then, you know, gave a little rating like you see in Consumer Reports as to which is the least hazardous versus what's the most hazardous. And people always ask about Shaklee and Amway products. And unfortunately, there are a variety of both of those products that rate down at the bottom in terms of relative hazard. Just buying Shaklee or Amway doesn't necessarily protect you from hazard. It depends on what the product actually is. Questions?
Yes.
Yes.
What are you using to clean your bathtub?
I have a shower.
Don't you have to use anything to shower?
Yeah, I use Bonama.
You use Bonama,
yeah.
Rather than Tommy.
Right, too. Right.
And glass wax on windshields and that sort of thing?
I usually use either vinegar and water or lemon juice and water for cleaning windows. Yeah, you can use ammonia as well.
Are you using Drano in good conscience?
No. Fortunately, we don't seem to get plugs in our drains.
You don't need that, so
yeah.
You don't know what to recommend.
The best thing to use is a plunger, old-fashioned plunger. Second best is a snake or one of those air bladders that hooks onto a garden hose if you really have a problem where, you know, you can't get the clog undone.
Right.
It's not so bad to use Drano if you're on a municipal sewer. If you have a septic tank, never ever use Drano. It can literally kill your the bugs in your septic tank.
I think they say if you regularly use, I think it's baking soda and vinegar, periodically every 2 weeks type of thing, it keeps it clear too.
Yeah, baking soda and vinegar will, when you mix it together, they foam, and that'll help keep it clean, and they're perfectly safe to dump down your drain.
Well, and again, it seems to me that it's one thing to say, well, you used to hear this Drano once a week.
Right, right.
Which, as far as I could tell, was really stupid. I didn't ever have that many clogs. So, you know, once in a while, maybe twice, maybe three times a year, my bathroom drain gets so clogged, I reach in and clean as much out with my fingers as I can, and then I use a little bit of Drano.
Right.
And I am on a municipal system. So, you know, I figured that's not so bad, but the Drano company wanted to sell its Drano and told us to use it once a week. And I think, you know, that's where you have to be careful. Is your sink really clogged? Is the plumber going to come in and use a caustic product to discombobulate your drain? Then you might as well use a little bit yourself. But if it's just to sell the product, don't bother.
I find Drano really interesting because, you know, it is lye, and it has little aluminum filings in it, and those little aluminum filings react with the lye when you add the water, and they actually act like little cutting bits in there. They whir around as they react, yeah.